Hey everybody, I'm an addict, my name is Bobby.
Hey Bobby!
From the Bronx in New York City. I'm putting these things up here to keep me honest so I get done before I bore everybody to death. So, I never done one of these before, so I'm going to pop my cherry right in front of you guys. First thing I want to say is that I'm proud to be a member of a fellowship that saves lives. So the second thing I want to say is that I thank God every day I was born with a penis. I would just so much rather be a man than a woman because it's so less complicated. I was telling somebody I met today, you know, men are stupid and women are crazy. Women want us to read their minds, and we actually try and do it. So, I'm an addict from the Bronx. I was born a long time ago. I'm 73 years old. Never thought I'd be this old. I'm so grateful I'm still alive. Don't understand it. I was born in the early 50s. By the time I was 5 years old, my brother, who was 11 years older than me, was taking me to bars, and I was hustling the guys at the bars for nickels so I could play Elvis and Little Richard. I love rock and roll right from the very beginning, and I still do. My musical tastes have diversified a bit since then, but it was probably my first addiction. Somebody asked me about 15 years ago, do you remember the first time you ever stole anything? And my mind went right back to being 5 years old, and I was slipping a little toy soldier of a friend of mine's into my pocket while his back was turned. So I guess I'm a recovering thief, too. It's still hard for me to walk past anything that's not nailed down when not actually contriving my mind how to remove it from whoever it belongs to. I haven't stolen anything in over 3 decades, but it's in there, you know. I believe that the DNA of a degenerate is inside of me, and this program helps me to keep it subdued. In 62, I guess it was, my brother came back from Southeast Asia, and I was under house arrest for allegedly having something to do with an arson in my neighborhood. And he was so proud of me. At that time, half the Marine Corps was criminals, and he was just back from a tour in Vietnam. And he, moved back into my parents' house. We hung out in the basement all summer long, drinking Schaefer, smoking Lucky Strikes, and learning, I was learning Tokyo street fighting, which was a great thing to go back to the fourth grade for, because my first day at school, a sixth grader was picking on a real short friend of mine, and he wound up laying on the ground trying to figure out what happened to him, and it was great. It was so empowering. And, I had a wise mouth right from the very beginning, so those kind of skills allowed me to survive my adolescence. I started drinking with my brother when I was 8. When I was 10, me and my pals we built a lot of model cars and planes and things, so we evolved into the tester's glue territory, and that was a lot of fun. I don't know if you guys remember that me 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 that thing. When I was 12, somebody turned me on to a joint, and I loved it. I loved it so much, actually, that I bought a kilo and went into business. In the 60s, we call that junior achievement. So my second kilo, the guy I was copping from, there was this, what I called an older woman at that point. She must have been about 16. I'm looking at her, and I'm wondering what she's doing there, and the guy goes, oh, this is Amy. Amy, why don't you take him in the back room and show him what you do around here? So I went in the back room with Amy, and she gave me the first sexual experience I ever had with another person. And I gave her a little bit of pot. And I was walking away from there, and my devious 12-year-old mind was thinking, I bet that's not the only Amy in the world. I bet the world is full of Amys. And I made sure from that point that I always had something with me to turn those Amys onto. Which kind of, you know, I started with rock and roll, moved into to drugs, and now there's the sex. So I had the Holy Trinity going for me at 12. At 14, somebody gave me a hit of acid. And I took off. It was great. It was fantastic. Psychedelics changed my life so many different ways. And, you know, the next year the Fillmore Reese opened up. And I don't know if you guys are familiar with that whole thing, but for $3.50 you could go see three world-class bands, three, four nights a week down in a village in New York City. And I spent a lot of time there. Actually, that's probably where I went to high school, because I don't remember much about actually attending classes. Things got more intense. I took more drugs. I sold more drugs. The Fillmore was, there was like they had this big lounge in the basement. And during the intermissions between each band, it was like an open marketplace. Cops left us alone. And everybody turned a good profit, and everybody in the whole place got high. But I managed to get out of high school, barely. I think in a class of 665, I graduated 660, barely. I went to college for 15 minutes, you know, best 15 minutes of my life. I went with a pencil and a bottle of wine. Met a girl, lost the pencil, drank the wine. Higher education. So at this point, my acid contact got blown off a mountain in Marin County, and I started drinking heavily. I had two people following me around. One was an unmarked car, and one was this guy that I went to high school with, whose girlfriend used to stop at my house every afternoon to party with me. And things were not looking good on either account. So I left town, went up in the mountains, continued to get high all the time, met a girl, traveled around the country a lot. Became more of a degenerate. I got high all the time, drank all the time. Scoot around on her all the time. Then we came back to New York City, and I got the dream job for somebody like me. I got a job tending bar. It was like giving Dracula the key to the blood bank. So I did that for a while, 7-8 years. And I don't know. Anybody at the morning meeting this morning? Anybody meet my wife, Susan? Yeah, so. Beautiful skinny girl walks in the bar, great smile, nice eyes. So the other bartender, who was a good friend of mine, gay man who joined the Marine Corps to meet men. I was working in a restaurant that was owned by a Jewish guy. It was an Italian restaurant, Puerto Rican cooks. Sebastian, the first night I worked there, some guy came in called Sebastian a faggot. He dragged him out on the street, kicked the shit out of him, and walked back in and said, only my friends call me faggot. So, and me. So it was an odd place. So Susan comes in and, you know, after she's had a few drinks with him, she had a couple drinks with me, and she was leaving, and I said, I want you to come back and see me, and she said, oh, I will, and I knew she was a liar. I mean, Susan was hot, you know, she was young and hot and sexy. The only thing that would have made her more sexy was if she carried a gun. So I said, come back here, and she goes, what do you want? I said, I want to kiss you. She goes, why? I said, because I'm a really good kisser, and I want to make sure you come back. And 2 days later, she came back, and as she said, a week after that, we moved in with each other. That was 40 years ago. Now, before that, my whole life I ran around like an alley cat, which I'm sure lots of you guys did too. I mean, what's the use of being a young man unless you're, you know, you enjoy it. So when I was around 20, I was seeing a few different girls, and my dad asked me, he goes, "You serious about any of these girls? What do you think of them?" And I said, "They're nice, I like them, you know." He goes, "Let me tell you something." He goes, "Women are like buses." He goes, "You know, sometimes a bus comes along, you get on it, you take it for one stop, and you get off. Another bus you might stay on three or four stops. Another bus you might take for a ride. But if you're really, really lucky, you find the bus that you get on and you take it to the end of the line. Like I did with Iman. And Susan was my end of the line bus. So that was 40 years ago. Never been in a relationship like this in my life, neither has she. But relationships are funny, you know, there's a million different kinds of them. And there's one of them for somebody. There's one of them for everybody. I was recently introduced to this guy who, his wife died a few years back. And he didn't know what to do with himself. I mean, he did a 90 and 90. That's what we all do when our wives die, I guess. But he took up ballroom dancing because he didn't know what else to do. And now he's a pretty good dancer. And I said, you know, I've always thought if something happened to Susan, I'd go to Arthur Murray. You know, you meet women, you move around, stuff like that. And he goes, "Why wait till she dies?" He goes, "If you do something independent of your relationship, it makes the interdependence of your relationship stronger." And I looked at him and I said, "You know what, man, I like you. You're a smart motherfucker." It's great when you meet people that are smarter than you. It's absolutely like, I feel like it's one of my best traits to recognize that, because we all think we're hip, quick, and slick, you know? I mean, we all think we got it over everybody else at some point in our life. But I think one of my finest aspects is to when I recognize that somebody's smarter than me, you know? Like you, I forget your name. Yeah, you.
Howard,
yeah. Man, you sound like you should be, doing the news. You know, really.
Legend.
And when you were up here speaking, I said, "I bet he's smarter than me." I could be wrong. I could be wrong. But that's what I thought. So full disclosure, right? You know, it's so hard for an addict to get up in front of a room and be honest. And it's like I'm so, you know, I'm a really good liar. And I try my best to be... I wasn't going to say that. I hope I didn't embarrass you. But it's really hard. Anyway, so me and Susan, we got together. We started selling bootleg T-shirts at rock and roll shows. So if you've ever been to a concert and gone outside in the parking lot after the show and somebody's out there going, $10, or whatever they charge nowadays, I don't know. That's what me and Susan did. We started on the Born in the USA tour with Bruce Springsteen, and we diversified to any band that was on tour. Had a great time for a few years. She got pregnant with a little help from me, and we were smoking a lot of crack at that point. And I tried to get her to stop because I didn't want to hurt the baby. And she wouldn't, and we kind of separated for a few months until she had the baby. And I wasn't done using, you know? I remember I was staying with my parents for a little bit, and she came over with the baby, and she handed me the baby, and I went in the back room and put American Beauty on. I put Ripple, which was a beautiful lullaby by the Grateful Dead, and I danced with my daughter, and I sang her that song. And years later, when my granddaughter was born, I did the same thing. And a few years later, when my grandson was born, I did the same thing. I'm glad I remember the words to that song. Because they seemed to like it. So after I was running around with these Mad Dog Road Warriors selling t-shirts all over the country. And I decided that since I was a dad now, which was something I never really considered, you know, it's funny, you go around having sex with all kinds of women all over the place when you're a young man, and you never think about being a father until somebody says, hey, I'm pregnant. You know, and then you say, oh, holy shit, what did I do? You know? So now I'm a dad, this beautiful little girl. And so I go to my first detox. And it's pretty much a waste of time. I don't know, maybe I didn't use for a month. And then the next year I went to another detox. And pretty much the same effect. And then the third year, I was getting closer to death. I mean, you could smell it on me. You know, I was like, I couldn't stand up straight anymore. It was like this. I was like, you know that show, The Walking Dead? That's what I felt like. I can never watch that show. It just reminds me of how I felt then. And so there was a guy on the t-shirt crew. His name is Frankie Wheels, and he had 10 years clean at that point. And Frankie told me, he was like, you know, trying to get us interested, especially me, interested in recovery. And he said, you know, I got 10 years clean, and I feel like this is the most dangerous part of my recovery because I feel like I know something now. Like I've arrived. And to this day, I remember that because I know now that every single day is the most dangerous day of my recovery. Because today is a day that I could use and fuck everything up, you know? Frankie took me to my last detox, walked in there, and as of September 16th, 1991, I never used again. Till now. I heard somebody say that at a meeting. I never used again. And I said, wow. Everybody in the room can identify with that statement. Each one of us have that moment. I never used again. Even if it's just 15 minutes ago. Each one of us had that moment where I never used again. And I thought it was just such a unifying statement. So that wasn't, you know, I was absolutely insane at that point. I had like 100 people in my head, and none of them would shut up. And I would like, you know, I'd go outside to smoke a cigarette and leave them in the room, and then they'd follow me out and ask me for cigarettes. I was diagnosed with alcoholic schizophrenia, you know, so I had lost touch with reality. And it was not an easy road back. It was not something I would ever want to have to do again. If I ever relapsed, it would be unlikely that I would come back. You know, a friend of mine met me, we went to a meeting. I went to a lot of meetings in the Bronx. As anybody who heard Susan today, you know, I was living with a real NA pain in the ass who would not relentlessly feed the program to me ad nauseum. And we did have to go to different meetings. Because she would sit there and like, blah, 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 blah. I mean, like, you know, I couldn't even sit next to her in the room. So gradually things got better. I immediately started a program of physical fitness because I figured if I'm not going to kill myself, I'm going to try and live as long as I can. I started eating really good. I took a lot of vitamins and nutrients and stuff like that. And within about 2 years, I pretty much reclaimed my body. You know, some of my mind, there was only about 5 people talking to me at once now. And I'd had some spiritual experiences. I was a little paranoid about sponsorship. The first guy asked to sponsor, died 2 days later. I didn't know he had the virus, and he just caught pneumonia and died like 2 days. You know, I called him once, I called him again, his wife said, oh, he's dead, you know. So I was a little leery about sponsorship. So it took me a while to get into the steps. Once I did, you know, I've been an avid reader my whole life. I stopped using, and the letters on the page just started running around. You know, I couldn't focus on anything longer than an IP. My favorite one of which, if anyone cares, is the Triangle of Self-Obsession, which begins with when we were born and ends with grow up or die. I mean, it just about covers the whole ball of wax. Susan, after a few years, went back to school to get a master's degree, and which I'd been telling her to get a master's degree for years, and she just said, yeah. She came home one day, and she goes, oh, you won't believe what my boss told me today. I said, what? She said, if I get a master's degree, I'll always have a job. And I looked at her, and I said, oh, that's a good idea. Never heard. You know, you never hear the things that the people you love say. Uh-huh. You know? I mean, I really have to think about that a lot to try and pay more attention, because I don't. I don't. Because she talks about so many things I have no interest in that a lot of times I miss some of the good stuff, you know? So she went to school and got a master's degree, got recruited, her career started taking off. Years later, I wanted to go to school because I was tired of selling t-shirts, you know, it was like something a lot of young guys did, and here I am pushing 40. So I went to school, a friend of mine, my daughter got ill. She started getting these awful pains, and somebody told me about Reiki, which is an energetic healing modality. So I took a course in Reiki, and I started treating my daughter, and she got better, and a couple of my friends heard about it, and they asked me to help them out. One of them was a very successful massage therapist in New York City. And he was very impressed. And he said, why don't you go to school and get a license and do what I do? And so I checked it out. I went to school for about a month, and I liked it. So I went to school for another 2 years, and I became a massage therapist. Because at that point, I was clean 7 or 8 years. And I thought, well, helping people feel better for the rest of my life sounds like a good thing to do. You know, I mean, it was at that point in my recovery where suddenly I was looking at situations, and instead of like saying, oh, let me help you do this, or let me help you do that, or maybe I can do this for you, before I opened my mouth, I did not think about what was in it for me. I started to think about just doing stuff because it was good stuff to do, you know? And about the same time, I finished my first set of steps, you know, I mean, the steps are like the vehicle that actually drives our recovery. Without the steps, we don't have recovery, you know. So there's that thing, you know, like there's 11 steps that say we, and there's that 12th step that says having had. It doesn't say we're going to do this, we're going to do that. It says something happened. Something happened to raise our awareness to a point where we can actually think about the possibility of becoming a better person a day at a time. So all this ball of wax stuff started congealing, and I never really did massage with anybody before. I found out I was really good at it. You know, there was a lot of body mechanics involved that, you know, I've been doing Qigong since I first got clean and yoga, and I had some martial arts stuff, and, you know, from my brother, and, you know, I just physically got into it, and I got really good at it, and I took this, like, really, this training of this very esoteric form of body work that very few people on earth practice. It's very, very gentle at neuromuscular work. And it's, you know, when I go to work, I touch flesh, and flesh is the envelope for the spirit. So when I go to work, I talk to God, and God talks back. It's really, really cool. So that's what I've been doing for 25 years. Sponsoring people, going to meetings, trying to grow spiritually. I learned a lot of shit early on. What you think about me is none of my business. I learned that those who matter don't judge, does a judge don't matter is a judgmental statement. And people that use it are people that I should watch out for. People that tell me how I'm supposed to do my recovery, maybe I should be leery of, because this is a fellowship that's founded on the idea of me not telling you what to do, but me telling you what I did. That's how it all started long back in the day. Bill and Dr. Bob, who were generous enough to lend us their steps and traditions. I learned how to ask for help. I learned that asking for help is the highest form of self-love. When I came in and people said, let us love you till you learn to love yourself, I said, fuck off. Who do you think you're talking to? You know? Man, I hug every single person I can. It's I love being a member of Narcotics Anonymous. The unconditional love that's been shown to me, and I've been to meetings in 38 states, okay, and several countries. I just came back from Thailand. There's a wonderful convention there every February. I was fortunate enough to catch my wife on a good day. She spent 6 months planning a vacation from. Man, we had a great time. We had a great time. But we went to, you know, when you're a member of The Walking Dead, you can only go so far. You know, I was lucky enough to travel because it was my job. Calling it a job is a ridiculous thing. It was like the thing I did, the hustle I had to make money. But to be able to, like, go 12,000 miles around the other side of the world and meet people from 44 different countries representing Narcotics Anonymous, representing their home groups in 44 different countries. And they did a countdown by country, and you know what? Nobody booed anybody else's country. There was none of that shit. And everybody clapped harder for the guy from the Ukraine than anybody else. You know, I've known a lot of beautiful people in this process, and a lot of them are dead. Out of sponsee. Guy's mother was a prostitute. His father took him on an armed robbery for his 16th birthday. He got himself set up with the Veterans Administration. He got what they call a golden ticket, where you get, like, all this money. You get, total disability. All he had to do was not smoke crack. When I copped, it was laced with fentanyl. Everybody loved this guy. Everybody loved him. And so many people have that thing. They got to go out. You know, there's a couple of, like, really misunderstood words in recovery. I think one of them is I'm having a massive brain fart now. What's the first step?
Powerless over our addiction, our lives had become unmanageable.
Powerlessness, right. I'm still jet lagged from the 20-hour trip. I'm really sorry, I apologize. So powerlessness is a word that, I don't know, it seems to me that people go through that first step, and even if, I ask my sponsees to read the first step every day for 30 days. They get bored. And they, I think, forget about that powerlessness thing. I think that's what people go, how people go out. They forget that they're powerless over their addiction. You know, I got 34 years clean. My addiction is not impressed. Not one bit. Not one bit. I wake up crazy every morning. I'm fine with that. Actually, I'm grateful that I have the awareness that I'm mentally ill. Because if I didn't have that awareness, I might forget that I'm powerless. And I would not want to see what would happen if I forgot I was powerless. The other word that I think is pretty much misunderstood and almost always mispronounced is anonymity. All right? And there's so many ways that we screw that up all of us. I mean, you know, I don't even know how many times I do it, because I got to tell you something today. I'm looking at Arnold. I met Arnold this morning. All right, this is how beautiful this program is. A truck driver from Baltimore, a massage therapist from the Bronx meet at breakfast. Sounds like a joke, right? A rabbi, a priest, and I walk into a bar, right? And we really hit it off. We're pals now, because we met on common ground, in an unconditional loving situation over eggs and bacon, you know? And this is a healthy thing. It's a healthy way to connect and develop relationships. I connected with like 100 people in Thailand from all over the world, you know? And I went to Alaska once. I went to a meeting in Fairbanks. I said, my name is Bobby. I'm from the Bronx. And some guy leans down and goes, "Hey, Bobby." I mean, there's a lot of characters in recovery, you know, and thank God that, you know, we can recognize it. I think humor is one of the most important things in recovery. I mean, I wake up laughing every day because I know I'm crazy. I know it's an absolute cosmic joke that I'm still alive, you know. I mean, I've done some dangerous things. I've done some stupid things. If you ever see the phrase "more balls than brains," my picture's there. I've never met a cliff that I didn't want to jump off of, you know. I raised a daughter that's a risk taker. She's got a job that she shouldn't have got for another 20 years. She's a smart girl, takes chances, you know. We all jumped off a cliff, 50-foot cliffs in Hawaii together when she was 16 years old. Now they'd call that child abuse. She thinks it's one of the best things I ever did for her, you know? We live in a universe of unending possibilities. And when I'm using, I don't see them. I don't see them. I see them now. I see a lot of things. I was just telling James that I was clean about 20 years, and somebody said, "It is what it is," in front of the room, like I am standing right here. And I thought, but what if it isn't? I was clean 20 years before that question came into my mind. I mean, I admit I'm a little slow sometimes, but the thing is like, the questions that come up in recovery are much more important than any of the answers that we ever look for. Because this is Narcotics Anonymous. This is simple shit. You don't use, you go to a meeting one day at a time and things get better. But it ain't easy. It's simple, not easy. And that's my motto, simple, not easy, you know? I go through my life, I try to find things out. Some things I try to understand, other things I realize I'll never understand, not in this life or the next. And that I let go, you know? Let go is one of my favorite exercises, because, man, when I got to the third step and it said, "Turn your will and your life over to a higher power," I said, "Man, that's a dope fiend step. Take it away from me and give it to somebody else. I don't have to deal with it." I love the third step. It's one of my favorite. 6 and 7, eternal steps. I got defects, ain't never going anywhere. And it's okay. It's okay not to be okay. Took me a long time to figure that out. Because, you know, we come in and we're all fucked up and we think we're perfectionists. You know? What do I have to do perfect except get high? You know? From the time I was 8 until I was 38, that's all I did. That was perfect. You know, my dad was a great guy. For a while, a few years out of my life when I was a teenager, I thought he was the biggest asshole in the world. Now, from what I understand from the people that know me and my family, I grew up and I'm exactly like him. That's okay with me too, because he was a good guy. And he taught me stuff that nobody else ever taught me. I asked him when I was a little kid, I said, "Dad, why do they call patience a virtue?" He goes, "Because they're wrong. Patience isn't a virtue. Patience is a skill. And you get better at it by practicing it, like anything else." You know, if ever Clapton can say, boy, it amazes me that the more I practice my guitar, the better I get at it, then I can practice patience on a daily basis and get better at it. I don't understand when people say, I don't have any patience. Well, get some, you know, practice, and you get it. That's pretty simple. Simple, not easy. Patience, not easy. Not easy at all. But it's simple, you know. It's like learning how to play guitar or play poker or play anything, you know. So if we play, if we look at life in recovery as play, the possibilities are endless. I don't take too much shit seriously. Never have. Probably never will. I take my recovery seriously because it saves my life. Every day, it saves my life. It prevents the horror of addiction from crawling into my family's lives and ruining them and making... I just... You know, I've done a lot of shit in my life. Some of it I'm ashamed of. Not much. You know, got a couple of regrets. Most of them involve, you know, maybe I could have treated a woman better than I did because instead of chasing another skirt, you know, I'm not a really bad person. I've done some bad things. I can forgive myself. I hope the people I've hurt can forgive me. And if they can't, I'm really not going to worry about it. I did a nine step a few times. Most people just said, hey, you know, just keep doing what you're doing. You know, you were scary before this. And I'm not scary anymore. Little kids come to me and hang out with me and we play. Dogs like me, you know. I remember once a lady was coming down the street with a stroller and she crossed to the other side of the street because she didn't want to be on the same side of the street as me. Mm-hmm. I remember the look in my mother's face when she understood that I was actually killing myself and she didn't know what to do. I don't ever want to see that look again. You know, we belong to this fellowship. It's a worldwide love fest. People connect 24 hours a day, all around the planet, every day of the year. And it's a real phenomenon. I feel so fortunate that I've been allowed, because I was on the way to the graveyard, man. Instead of making a left, I made a right. I wound up in Narcotics Anonymous, and my life has gotten just exponentially better ever since. It's like, you know, if you got on like the Starship Enterprise and like went warp speed for 30 years, where would that take you? How much would you change? Well, that's how much my life has changed. And like I'm a completely different person than I was when I started. And yet I know that that degenerate DNA is still in there. And that's something that I do have to be careful about, because if I don't remember how crazy I am, that guy can come back. And believe me, nobody in this room wants to meet that guy. We're all natural born killers. Every single one of us. And I don't want to see that guy around anymore. So, I think I'm done. I want to tell you something that the main reason I was actually able to get clean was because I came to meetings and I paid attention to the speaker. And I've always admired the courage that it took any addict to get up in front of a room and try and tell the truth. You know, I read this report years ago that Yale did. They asked like several thousand people about public speaking, and it turns out that 75% of humans would rather die than get in front of a room and talk. And then after 90 days, they told me, listen, I want you to speak, and we don't appreciate colorful language. And I thought to myself, oh, you take away my drugs, the way I was living, my entire life, and now they want to take away half my fucking vocabulary. So I want to tell you that I'm grateful to all of you that have ever stood in front of a room. And I want to tell you what somebody told me once, that there's somebody out there whose recovery and absolute life depend upon you carrying the message, the loving message of Narcotics Anonymous. So thank you very much, gentlemen.
That's coming back.